Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for Friday, the very end of the week, March 8th. And let me see if I can give you a clue of what we have in mind today. Today, I'm going to open up the first public hearing on three bills and an informational meeting on the fourth bill, which we don't have yet. We'll start with a bit of discussion from the Oregon Health Authority and the Governor's Office on two of the bills, and some discussion with the Insurance Division on two of the other bills, one bill and one LC that's in process, where I have to acknowledge that we're driving our poor drafter, Lori Freeman, crazy with a bunch of bills, all of which need to be done yesterday or the day before at the very latest. So we're moving along. There will be some amendments to some of these bills. Are they already on OLS?
The ones for 2240.
Right? The ones for 2240. There are three amendments proposed for 2240. One is basically, I think, a gut and stuff of the bill, I think.
About half of that, about half a gut and stuff.
About half a gut, half gut or half stuff. So I am opening a public hearing on House Bill 2240, 2859, 2091, and an informational meeting on a bill that we have in LC form. Is that right?
And then also.
Oh, and also, I did say 2240.
Oh, did you?
Yep. If I didn't, 2240. And a bill on a state supplemental reinsurance program that the folks from the Insurance Division will introduce us to. But we can start with Dr. Goldberg. Who are you bringing with to protect you? Mr. Savage is going to bring somebody along to protect him as well. It's always good to have the political person and then somebody who knows something.
Usually I need two.
Yeah. For the record, limp-log with just one today.
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. Judy Moore Peterson and I are here to walk you very briefly through two bills. One is House Bill 2859. And the other is House Bill 2091. I'll start with House Bill 2859. This is a bill that primarily conforms state law with new federal law regarding Medicaid. And what the bill does is it removes medical assistance from the definition of public assistance and makes a number of technical and conforming changes to set out medical assistance as something unique and to its own and different from public assistance. And then the bill conforms state medical assistance eligibility statutes with changes in federal law by providing within available funds medical assistance to persons who are spelled out by federal Medicaid law.
And this has a subsequent to Ways and Means.
Correct. Because this will then deal with funding of the Oregon Health Plan. It requires that applicants for medical assistance be treated in a courteous, fair, and dignified manner. It allows both the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority to accept applications for medical assistance and verify eligibility information, which is key in federal Medicaid law. And it clarifies medical assistance eligibility and redetermination requirements per federal law. That's done in Section 44 and Section 77 make the required eligibility changes that line us up with federal law. Section 1 does something that I don't think we need a or should have a still to do. It requires us to be courteous, and I would hope we always do that. But I do think it's a good thing to have that in statute. And then the remainder of the bill primarily lines up medical assistance and public assistance. There are some, I believe, dash 2 and dash 3 amendments coming, but that's really the bulk of the bill.
Good. Are there any questions? Okay.
Okay, then we can even quicker can walk you through House Bill 2091, which is in essence a gut and stuff. This is being written with what will be the dash 1 amendments right now. I don't believe that you have those yet. But what this bill does is, when I was before you earlier in the week, we talked about the changes to the Healthy Kids Program. And what this bill does is two things. It statutorily removes the requirement that all children between 200 and 300% of poverty go into the Healthy Kids Premium Assistance Program. It establishes the ability to have children between 200 and 300% of poverty in the Oregon Health Plan. And it spells out the need for an orderly transition as we go through the year.
Okay. Are there any questions on that? You have a question?
Is anybody opposed?
I don't think we have. I think there is no opposition to any of the four bills we're hearing today. They've all been, I think, and we'll hear, we have about 10 witnesses have asked to comment. There may be some suggestions about things, but basically I think we've worked these pretty well out with, I think, but we'll hear. President Conger?
I just had a question. Do you have any sense of how the benefits would change by the change in designation?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Conger, kids will have a greater benefit in the Oregon Health Plan than they do currently in the Healthy Kids Connect program. I can't tell you exactly, I don't know if Judy could talk exactly about the benefits, but there are a number of services that are covered in the Oregon Health Plan that are not generally covered in commercial insurance, primarily, you know, services for kids that have severe chronic illnesses, a lot of home care services, some durable medical equipment that generally isn't covered in a commercial insurance benefit. So it's a fuller benefit, and there is less cost sharing for those families.
Mr. Chair,
I just want to ask you a comment. In the Healthy Kids Program, as we worked out in 2016, it had three different components. One for kids between under 200% of the poverty level. They went into straight Medicaid, and there's no change in that group.
Correct.
Right. The group between 200 and 300% had a highly subsidized program, and those kids are going to be going into Medicaid.
Correct.
As well. The ones over 300% will be handled as a part of the exchange, I think. Is that right?
That's correct, Chair Greenlick.
And this bill simply works out those pieces.
Yes.
President Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Goldberg, just looking at this and with the movement into the Medicaid population, then we have everything going on with CCOs. I'm just wondering, because we have some other bills that might mess with the cost on this, and one of them would be basically the nurse practitioner bill with parity with doctors on payment. Is that going to cause that payments for these children to increase possibly, or is it we going to see an increase in Medicaid payments if that bill was to go forward?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Widener, My understanding about certainly one of the payment bills is that it excluded payment parity in Medicaid. If it mandated payment parity in Medicaid, what would happen is that the CCOs would be required to make those additional payments, but the CCOs would not be given any additional dollars to make those payments. So they would have to figure out where within their global budget they would take some dollars to make those additional payments, because part of now what we've done with CCOs is established a fixed budget. So any mandate for additional payment for anybody, any additional service that's done in Medicaid, there's no dollars that go with that to the CCOs.
Mr. Chair, I had a follow-up.
Please.
Thank you. Can you... I didn't actually look. I should have looked first, but do we have a cost estimate for this bill?
Chair Greenleck, Rep. Conger, we have an early estimate. My only hesitation is that it depends on the new caseload forecast, but our sense is that this will be somewhere in the range of about a $10 to $12 million general fund savings to make this change.
May I follow up one more time? If we're providing more benefits, and then this is, so I'm make sure I'm clear on this before I say my question.
Simple arithmetic, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. That's what's mystifying. So currently they're getting the kids who are enrolled in the program between the 200 and 300. So I know we're talking about only some of the kids. They're getting commercial insurance, and they're getting a premium subsidy from the state in order to help them obtain that. The cost is less, but the benefits are more.
Correct.
Under Medicaid, which is somewhat counterintuitive.
Chair Greenleg, Rep. Conger, there's
the cost of the state is less.
There's a couple reasons for that. One is the benefit itself is priced at Medicaid pricing as opposed to commercial pricing. And so, therefore, there's a savings to the state, but generally the payments to providers are less. And that's the primary reason for the savings.
Thank you. But
it's also a savings in state general funds because it's a larger proportion of pickup on it, isn't it?
The match is the same.
Your head shaking,
yeah.
No, it's fine.
I like that.
Members of the committee, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the Director of Medical Assistance Programs with the Oregon Health Authority, and the match rate is the same between either program.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, guys, very much. Let's see. I think we're going to have Mr. Savage and Ms. Colley. Is that right?
She's going to actually come in the next round.
So the next round?
Yeah.
What's the next round?
The next round is reinsurance.
Okay. So you're going to talk about one bill.
Right. Chair Greenleg, members of the committee, Lou Savage, Oregon Insurance Division. With me today is Anthony Behrens, who's our senior policy analyst. Barney Spate gave a review on Wednesday of the private market, and as he mentioned, the Affordable Care Act makes significant changes to health insurance regulation, prohibits pre-existing condition exclusions, requires coverage of essential health benefits at specific actuarial value levels, guarantees access to coverage regardless of health condition, and specifies rating factors. This is probably the biggest change in the private market in decades with respect to how insurance is purchased and how it's regulated. The legislature actually took the first step in reform back in 2011 when you passed Senate Bill 98. House Bill 2240 is really the second step in this process. This, as you can see, is a huge bill. We spent a lot of time with stakeholders on this, trying to get it right. But the problem was that by the time we needed to submit this bill, the federal government in its wisdom had not yet decided which way it wanted to go on specific aspects of the ACA. So the amendments total 42 pages, and we will I'll mention that as we go along. But
those are the dash two amendments.
Those are the dash two amendments, correct. I'll mention those amendments as we go along, but we can certainly have a more detailed discussion next week. We actually got the amendments earlier today. They look pretty good. There may be some tweaks needed, but I think they look pretty good. Lori Freeman did a great job under trying circumstances. What I'd like to do is to go through the highlights of the bill and mention where there will be some amendments. I know that there are a couple amendments that have been offered. We just saw them this afternoon when we came in. We're certainly happy to have a discussion with the industry about those. So let's get started. Section 2 of the bill grants DCBS the authority to define essential health benefits according to federal law. About a year ago, we started the process of determining which benchmark plan the governor would submit to Health and Human Services for approval. That was a fairly long process and involved a work group that consisted of consumers, industry, business, and we ended up with a Pacific Source small employer plan, and that's the one that was ultimately submitted to the feds. Section 3, and this is on page 2, grants authority for the department to establish by rule a risk adjustment program in the event that we need to facilitate implementation of the federal risk adjustment program, or in the event after 2 years the state makes a decision to run the risk adjustment program itself. We made the determination that for the first 2 years it would be just as well that HHS run that program, but this does grant the department the authority to adopt a program if we think it's the right way to go, and of course we would be consulting with industry as well as this body if we went ahead and made that move. The next section I wanted to mention was Section 6 on page 3. It grants DCBS the authority to streamline insurer notice requirements to ensure compliance with the ACA and to encourage administrative efficiency. We were working with the industry on this. We actually have an amendment to clarify that the goal in this provision is actually to avoid duplication. We want to make sure that, in fact, consumers don't get too many notices because that can be confusing. Section 5 and Section 15, this is starts on page 3 and then it goes to page shoots over to page 11. This is the student health plan provision. It grants authority to DCBS to create requirements for student health benefit plans to ensure they're consistent with regulations adopted by the ACA. And then on page 4, section 9, grants the department the authority to regulate multi-state plans by including multi-state plans in the definition of transacting insurance. The reason this section is important is that it ensures that these plans are subject to the same regulations as plans sold only in Oregon and makes certain that all Oregonians have the same protection under the code as they would get if they bought a plan from a domestic insurer. Page 4, also on Section 8, the operation of the health exchange, there's some specific requirements and some provisions that we've put in. One is to establish network adequacy requirements. Again, that's page 4, section 8. We've had discussions with the industry about this, and I will tell you in advance, there's some concern about having DCBS adopt these network adequacy requirements by rule. We are certainly open to a discussion with the industry about that subject, but we do think it's important to have a provision in the Act which requires a network adequacy provision and some analysis of what would be appropriate. We don't have anything written down in terms of what this would look like. There's nothing that we want to do that would impact an insurer's ability to be creative with respect to networks, but we do think some oversight is important. Page 4, Section 9, excuse me, I already hit that. That's multi-state plans. There's also a provision regarding, this is both small group and individual coverage for multi-state plans. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Page 16 eliminates the, and this is Section 17. Page 16 eliminates the Oregon Standard Health Statement, as carriers are no longer allowed to deny coverage based on health status. Requiring that as a basis for eligibility would be a violation of the ACA. However, we are part of our amendment package will allow carriers to ask questions for medical management purposes, and we agreed with them that we thought this is important with respect to better management of health issues. Section 17, page 13, and Section 21, page 19. These two sections together repeal the small employer health insurance benefit plan requirements in light of the fact that the ACA has an essential health benefit requirement and actuarial value requirements that apply to both the individual market and the small group market. Page 13, Section 17. Changes the definition of bona fide associations so that it's consistent with federal law.
Did you say page 13?
Yes. Down, it's line 36.
Yes. That significantly changed in the amendments?
The amendment clarifies the definition. Anthony, I don't know if you want to make a comment.
Okay. For the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm with the Department of Consumer Business Services Insurance Division. Chair Greenlich, the amendment, and I apologize, I haven't had a chance to thoroughly look through the amendments, but the discussions we had with Legislative Council, the amendment should basically ensure that those elements of the federal definition of bona fide association are present, and then there are under the federal definition there are some state requirements which we currently already have in a separate section, so this would kind of put them all in one place, and that's essentially bylaws, and that the association can't be controlled by an insurer.
So on page 16, which is part of section 17, we define individual health benefit plans, again, to make it consistent with federal law. Page 17, this is one of the most important provisions of the bill. It defines pre-existing condition. This is starts on line 3 of page 17. Defines pre-existing condition so that it's consistent with federal law to ensure that insurers can't exclude or deny coverage to Oregonians based on pre-existing condition. Part of our amendments will ensure that the definition applies to large group benefit plans as well, because the ACA, as you know, applies to large group benefit plans. Again, page 17, we're changing the staff statutory definition of small group from 2 to 50, and then from 1 to 50, and from 2 to 50 to 1 to 50 in 2013. And then a delayed provision that will change the definition from 1 to 100 in 2016, and that's on page 94. Going over to page 21, we're changing the small group and individual rating factors to conform them to the requirements of the ACA. Under the ACA, rating factors for individual and small group markets are limited to composition, which is family or individual, geographic rating areas, age, and tobacco use. And that's on page 21, section 22, and page 34, section 29. Also on page 34, we requiring issuers of health plans to pool all individual market risks, and that's inside and outside the exchange, and small group market risks. That's section 29, page 34. On page 39, we're modifying the Oregon clinical trials mandate to be consistent with the ACA mandate. That's page 34, excuse me, page 39, section 34. And the last provision I'll mention is that we are repealing the portability statutes in light of the ACA's guaranteed issue provisions, and that is at the very end of the bill on page 98, section 83, we're repealing the portability statutes. The amendment, though, ensures that the portability coverage terminates no later than December 31, 2013. So I know I ran through those pretty quickly. Those are the highlights. Certainly be glad to answer any questions and come back and talk about the amendments as well.
That thing in clinical trials, does it change things materially? Looks like not.
Chair Greenlink, I think that's not the case in terms of how we have viewed the statute, but I'll let Anthony comment as well.
Chair Greenlink, yeah, that's correct. The changes are just relatively minor, just to ensure consistency with the federal requirement.
Okay. Any questions? You numbed into submission.
So I have a question.
Chair. Yes, go ahead.
Very early you mentioned benchmark plan in Oregon. So I'd like to understand. So does each state then have a different benchmark plan under the ACA? And again, what's the implications? I mean, is the implication just what is offered within the plan, or what other implications does it have?
Chair Greenlink, Representative Lively, I'll get started on this, and then I'll have Anthony jump in. The ACA, the Affordable Care Act, requires that any plan have the 10 essential benefits. Mm-hmm. States were free to choose a plan that existed in their state, and there were specific plans that they could look at to make that determination, and one of them was the a small employer plan. One of the for lack of a better description, one of the most popular small employer plans. We went through a process where we basically laid everything out on the table with respect to which plans could qualify as a benchmark plan. The work group went through a process to determine what was the best plan to represent the benchmark plan. Now, I'll turn it over to Anthony with respect to some modifications that the carriers can do. But the answer to your question is yes. Different states will have different benchmark plans, and I will say that the group. When it came to a decision, there was broad consensus that the benchmark plan ought to be the most affordable because insurers could still offer in the exchange and outside of the exchange plans that were more robust. But whether it was a consumer group or industry group or small business, that was the primary goal, was to have a benchmark plan that was the most affordable. Anthony, you want anything more?
Just real briefly, Chair Greenlink, Representative Lively. So there were some national, potentially national plans that states could have chosen. Mm-hmm. However, I'm not aware of actually any states choosing those national options, and I believe for the most part, most states have chosen their small group plan as their benchmark. That's my understanding.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to the next bill.
Okay.
I'm going to ask, if you can.
Yeah. I'm going to ask Laura Kelly to come up and walk you through this. Laura is our chief actuary and manager of our product regulation section in the insurance division. Barney Spate kind of kicked this off on Wednesday, talking about the state reinsurance program. It would provide additional stop-loss protection for high claim costs associated with folks moving from OMIP, FMIP, Children's Reinsurance, and Portability to the private market, and would be funded by assessments similar to the current OMIP program. So I'm going to turn it over to Laura. Laura led a work group, a technical advisory group made up of actuaries, and we brought in small business representatives towards the end of the process to talk about it as well. So I'll turn it over to Laura.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Calley. I'm the chief actuary and the manager of product regulation for the insurance division. And Lou teed up a lot of the major details, but I wanted to make reference to something that Barney Spate mentioned on Wednesday. He talked about the impact of the submarket merger on the individual market. So that's the influx of those that are currently on OMIP, FMIP, and portability plans in particular that will be coming into the individual market. And that's expected to have a very significant impact on premiums in the individual market. The estimates from our consultants were about a 22% increase in premiums on average in the individual market. Barney had also addressed the expected impact of the federal program that is a national uniform program. And that's expected, if fully funded, to reduce the increase in premiums by about 11%. On average in the individual market. So it really only gets at part of that submarket merger in addition to all of the other effects of the ACA reforms. So we believe that there was a need to do something additional to the federal program to provide additional relief in the early years and ensure that there's access to affordable coverage and that we maximize participation in the individual market. So as Lou mentioned, we conducted a technical advisory group that I led. It included representatives from the insurance division, from Cover Oregon, from the governor's office, as well as senior actuaries from industry insurance, health insurers. And the charge of the group was to review models that our actuarial consultant had prepared. And those models provided information about the federal program and that impact on the premiums in the individual market, but also gave us flexibility as a group to review different structural options for an additional program that the state would operate. And the group considered some kind of major principles in assessing what would be a reasonable structure of that program. And some of them were requirements, and others were things that the group really felt were important to make sure the program were successful. So the biggest one, and the one that was a requirement, is that a state program could not overlap with the federal program. So it could not target the same layer of claims that the federal program would plan to pay. And you know, obviously, it's ideal that we don't want to kind of throw state money at something that federal funds are already earmarked for. We also wanted to target key areas of risk in the market so that we could really maximize the impact and target areas of uncertainty so that we could really try to keep premiums as low as possible. We also wanted to maintain incentives for insurers to manage claim costs. We didn't want to offer such broad coverage that it removed those incentives. It should provide a meaningful impact, and it should also phase out over a period of time, like the federal program, but provide kind of a softer landing than just an abrupt end to the program. Because I think Barney mentioned also on Wednesday that this doesn't really change the costs in the individual market. It kind of smooths out the increases that may occur. So the recommended design from the technical group is a supplemental program that actually targets a very specific set of population. It's those that are that are members of OMIP, FMIP, or portability plans, or the Children's Reinsurance Program as of December 31st of 2013, and it provides additional payments for claims. It claims in a fairly broad layer, and it wraps around the federal program. It's proposed to be funded through an assessment similar to the current OMIP assessment, so it's on all insured plans as well as self-insured plans who buy stop loss. And in the first year, that would not exceed $4 per member per month. The payment parameters, the federal program, as Barney had mentioned, is expected to pay 80% of the claims dollars between $60,000 and $250,000 per member per year. And this program for the subject populations would actually drop down below that and pay 90% between $30,000 and $60,000. It would also pay 90% between $250,000 and $300,000. And it would provide an additional 10% in the layer from $60,000 to $250,000. So the same layer as the federal, but just an extra amount of coinsurance. And the combined effect of these two programs would be to reduce estimated average premium increases by 14.9%. And that's compared to the 11% impact that was mentioned earlier of the federal program alone. And I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Great. Thank you very much. We'll have more chance to talk about it when we have an actual bill in front of us.
Okay.
Although we'll be taking testimony on the general principles of the bill.
Thank you
very much. We've got 10 people to sign up, which means you can get about 5 minutes each. You don't have to use your 5 minutes, but we'll hold you to that, and that will get us out of here on time. And I think I'll just take you in the order that I have you signed up. Please announce when you introduce yourself which bills you're providing testimony on, and it could be any one of three bills plus or all plus the reinsurance proposal. So let me start with Tom Hope, John Mullen, and Arthur Towers. Following that, it'll be Jeremy Vandehey, Marion Blankenship, and Jesse O'Brien will be the next three.
Chair Greenlink and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Here today, both on House Bill 2240 and on the reinsurance concept. We have submitted on 2240 two additional amendments I'll speak to, which are the dash threes and fours. And there are just an additional question that we think would be important for the committee to look at as we continue to work this bill. But I would say in an environment with new rules coming from the feds on a regular basis, the insurance division has done a really good job in dealing with this very technical matter. The most recent bolus of big rules that were, you know, wonderful nighttime reading if your insomnia is giving you a problem came through last Friday of several hundred pages. So with that in mind and not having had a chance to read the OID's package of amendments, which we have discussed with them in some concept, I'm going to speak to the original bill and what we are aware of with the amendments. Our two amendments do two things. One, the dash three, I believe it is. Yes, dash three removes
in front of you.
Yeah, which, or I think you have in front of you now. It's a very simple amendment, but an important one in our view. It would remove the requirement to offer gold plans as a condition of licensure in the state of Oregon. It does not change the requirement that exists under federal law and with the Oregon, with Cover Oregon, the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange's requirements that we offer gold inside the exchange. And our reasoning on that is that the gold plans are the richest plans that will be required to be offered. They will be very expensive relative to the other plans in the market. And we believe that the market for that is going to be almost entirely inside the exchange because they're really going to be most affordable for those who are going to be able to receive substantial subsidies. Outside the exchange, based on our experience just in recent years and seeing what people do with the lower deductible plans, we just don't think there's going to be much of a market for it. And while this is an important benefit level to offer in the exchange, outside the exchange, there's an expense to offering a plan that there are basically no customers for. We would, with all the other cost areas that we're looking to bring more efficiencies on, we think this is a requirement that could be done without as a condition of licensure so that we would, you know, again, we would offer the gold plans inside the exchange but have the option of offering or not. We would offer inside but have the option of offering or not outside the exchange.
So the limit would be silver in that case.
Pardon me, sir?
The limit would be silver is what you're proposing.
Yeah, outside the exchange, we would still have to offer bronze and silver. Okay. That's existing state law, which we were supportive of in the last session. In the other amendment is the dash four. And it would simply remove the requirement or the authority for the insurance division to devise rules around network adequacy. We're going to have to meet either NCQA or an organization called URAC standards for network adequacy for exchange products. We're not going to do anything different in terms of our networks in or out of the exchange, and we wouldn't expect others to do that either. And there's been no real identified problem here. So it's sort of an authority in search of a problem. And what concerns us is that it would tend to invite a lot of lobbying by providers who would rather that we pay them a whole lot more money to impose an adequacy requirement that helps them.
30 seconds, Tom.
And then the last thing that I wanted to just touch on, the reinsurance concept, we're very supportive of. We're concerned that in the absence of a state-based reinsurance program, there'd be some risk of, substantial risk of instability in the individual market. The smoothing of rates for the individuals is very important, but instability can be contagious, and so it wouldn't, the problems we think would not be contained to the individual market, and so we think this is a good concept, and we look forward to seeing the legislative language on it.
And you generally support both of them, given
in general with, you know, with our suggestions. Oh, I did want to mention one other thing. I'm sorry. There is a question raised about the interplay of Oregon's small group rules and our current self-insurance limits. We don't know the answer to it, but it's one of those things with all the rules coming out that we're trying to interpret. But the effect of the change of small group definition would take some employers that are kind of just above what's now a small group and they are buying substantial reinsurance and require them to go fully insured, which would cost them more and make them less likely to provide benefits. But we think that's just a question in the air that we should examine.
Thank you. Mr. Mullen.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2859. In the work that I've done with the Oregon Law Center and also with the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, we've talked from time to time about the changes that have happened with transformation, including the splitting of Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. You had a little bit of the background on Wednesday going back to the 2007 session about the way in which our modern discussion of transformation has worked. With what happened in House Bill 2009 in the 2009 session, among a number of other things that created that split with the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services, there were a number of cleanup bills that came about because of the functions in the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. For example, after the passage of House Bill 2009, the Oregon Health Authority became involved in eligibility, which was not originally envisioned in House Bill 2009. And so the discussion that goes on in this bill about medical assistance and public assistance and the splitting is really reflective of the splitting into two separate organizations. I confused members of the committee on the very first day of session when I came and testified on House Bill 2089, which is rapidly has been on its way to final passage. We were interested to amend that particular bill, and with working with your office, Mr. Chair, and also with the Oregon Health Authority, we had some satisfactory resolution of the things that we were concerned about that I was mentioning on that day, the notice and hearing requirements, which you'll see, is up on OLIS now, the Dash 2 amendments, which is comes from the work that we've done. A few other things that I'll mention as this bill goes forward that are of concern to us are in Section 25 about authorized representative, to clarify that the language that people can have the authorized representative in a hearing process that makes sense to them, and we have put in clarifying language about that for your consideration. In Section 32, our concerns are taken care of with the amending of ORS 411-095 about the hearing and notice issues I just mentioned. But we're also concerned that in Section 32 that the General Assistance Program doesn't go away. A number of you have signed on to House Bill 2712, where we hope to get the discussion about general assistance restarted and refunding it. So with this discussion about medical versus public assistance in the mix there, the general assistance in the original bill was taken out of statute, which we don't want. A couple of other things which are very technical. In Section 39, we would like to add OSIP, Medical Oregon Supplemental Insurance Program, along with Oregon Supplemental Insurance, to ensure that we're also talking about the long-term care population. So we just want to make sure that that's covered. Section 54 has to do with recipient disqualifications. We don't believe that what's in this particular bill is allowable under federal law, but we will be happy to have the view of legislative counsel as they look at amendments on that. And then finally, Section 94, which makes it consistency with the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program. That very first day of session, that bill, Senate Bill 203, was up for discussion. And basically what's happening here is the Federal Communications Commission is requiring that states come into uniformity about eligibility from state to state for this telephone assistance program. Our amendment is just a very simple one about changing the federal poverty level designation in the original bill to 138% of federal poverty level so that it covers people on Medicaid as Medicaid expands. So just with that, conclude my remarks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. There probably will be other things over the next number of years that will require some changes as we look at how DHS and OHA operate together. So these works in progress will continue. But in the main, as advocates, we are all trying to keep up with all of these changes as you are as legislators. And there are a myriad of things that have to do with working with four different agencies, DCBS, the Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority, and Cover Oregon. And so we will continue with our advocacy efforts along those lines. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss these amendments.
Thank you. I'm not sure we're going to get this all right, but fortunately we have a February session that comes pretty soon where I assume we're going to be straightening out things that we've missed in this one. Okay, Mr. Towers.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. I wanted to speak to House Bill 2240 today. The big thing to remember about our union is that we represent nearly 20,000 workers.
You also noted for the reinsurance that you're speaking as well.
Yeah, I do also want to speak to the reinsurance, correct. Our union represents nearly 20,000 workers who don't have employment-based insurance. I handed out a quick chart showing who those folks are. But they're home care providers for the elderly and people with disabilities, personal support workers for people with developmental disabilities, child care providers, and they operate adult foster homes. And we're extremely intrigued about the opportunities for our members to purchase quality and affordable health insurance via Cover Oregon on the exchange. So currently the Cover Oregon and the insurance division are setting the standards upon which the insurance carriers will compete in the exchange market, and it's very much on the right track, and the governor and his team, Cover Oregon, the insurance division, they're all, again, doing very good work to get us in the right direction. We do support the governor's effort around risk adjustment and the state reinsurance proposals in order to help bring down the health insurance costs for consumers. We realize that there may be cost increases because we haven't addressed all of the cost drivers under the ACA, but this feels like a good first step for Oregon to provide health care for the uninsured and to ultimately make health care more affordable for everybody involved. However, we still have to prevent a further premium price shock for those who may be purchasing insurance via the exchange. While it's not under this committee's jurisdiction, we strongly believe that Oregon's insurance rate review program must be strengthened to make sure that any new rate increases are truly justified. We also feel that the legislature needs to take concrete steps to ensure that Oregon's health insurance exchange is implemented correctly to bring about affordable quality health plans for our members who will be purchasing this way. And so that means that Cover Oregon has to have the tools necessary to contain costs and to improve quality in the health plans offered in the healthcare system. So we have a handful of recommendations for the legislature to give statutory authority to the exchange by the 2015 open enrollment period. Specifically, we believe that the exchange should have the power to negotiate with insurers on premium rates and cost sharing. We know that they're not allowed to, the Cover Oregon's not allowed to set rates, but they can negotiate. Secondly, we believe that the exchange should add at least two quality improvement strategies to its qualified health plans, update these strategies every 2 years to reflect the need for cost containment and quality improvement. This could be setting standards around hospital readmission, health disparities, things along those lines. Cover Oregon should have the statutory authority to prevent reimbursements for never events in the qualified health plans, to require insurers to submit a plan of action for qualified health plans that show that the providers with the worst outcomes will be excluded from the qualified health plans, to require that no plan will have a medical loss ratio below 85%, and to require Cover Oregon to adopt a quality metrics rating committee to align their quality metrics with those of the CCOs where it makes sense. Again, we see a lot of our members being covered by coordinated care organizations. In fact, I think that we're the largest membership organization in the state of Oregon Health Plan recipients. And so we're concerned about making sure these metrics align. So let me just close by saying that we appreciate the heavy lift that this committee has in terms of making all this stuff work, and I think that your job security is in order, because I don't think it's going to be the 14th session alone, but 15, 16, 17, we're going to be coming back to get all this stuff unraveled. So thank
That's
you very
gonna
much.
It's going to be up to the voters, I think. I just can note there is an amendment being prepared to a bill we have in our possession to give us a chance to consider the issues that you've just raised, and we will be taking a look at that. Thank you.
Can I have a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Arthur, thank you. I know you represent many of the people at the lower end of the spectrum in terms of working families. Do you have any idea of what the percentage are of these 20,000 people that are currently on OHP? And then do you have another percentage of the people that that would be included when it goes up to 138%?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, we have about, of our care providers, we have about 4,200 that currently have health insurance. Those are in-home care providers for seniors and people with physical disabilities. We don't know for sure how many are on the Oregon Health Plan currently. Mm-hmm. We do know that, according to a recent study of a couple years ago now that the DHS put forward, that the Home Care Commission was the second largest employer after Walmart in terms of the number of employees it has on public assistance. Mm-hmm. And finally, in regard to how many of these folks would be qualified for the exchange, again, we're not sure because of the the income eligibility is based on household income. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to do the research now to figure out how many would qualify in each of the various areas.
Across the expansion of Medicaid as well as the subsidy.
Right.
I'm hoping a lot more of them are covered.
Thank you guys very much. Jeremy Vandehe, Marion Blankenship, and Jesse O'Brien. One of the advantages of having you let us know in advance that you were going to testify is I actually have a list that's printed so I can read it. That's very helpful.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, I'll be, for the record, Jeremy Vandehe with Kaiser Permanente, and I'll be fairly brief. Thank you for having me. We signed up on Wednesday, not really sure which amendments or which bills would be available today. As with the insurance division, we're still digging through the dash 2s to 2240. I did just want to say, generally, we're supportive of the efforts of the insurance division and the governor's office to bring these priority bills forward, and generally believe that the concepts are good for Oregonians. But we'll be looking at the amendments and the bill for the reinsurance program as it comes out, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to provide comments if we have any, but look for it. I also just wanted to thank the governor's office and the insurance division for the opportunity to meet with us over these complicated matters the last few weeks, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity next week to review these with them as well.
I do want to comment that these bills will come back, except for the reinsurance bill, which will have its first public hearing as soon as we get it. Bills will come back under work session, so if you want to be testifying on issues for them when they get listed for work session, please let the administrator know.
Great, thank you.
Great. Chair Greenlink, Vice Chair
Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marion Blankenship. I'm the Director of Government Relations and the Executive Director of the Charitable Foundation for Pacific Source. I read this morning that gratitude is good for our health. So in the spirit of that, I am grateful that it is Friday and that it is sunny. And if we can extend that health benefit to optimism, I think we might all survive the ACA, but I'm not entirely sure yet. I echo my colleague Jeremy's comments. We really haven't had a chance to dig into any of the amendments at this point, nor have we actually seen the reinsurance bill. However, we have been really involved all throughout the process. And again, I echo the sentiments in terms of just what we have seen throughout the last year, quite frankly, to be a productive partnership with the insurance division, the OHA, and also with Cover Oregon as well.
Did you introduce yourself? I wasn't.
Yeah. Marion, yeah, Blankenship.
No, okay, I was fooling around with the timer. And I just
okay, and I will be brief. So really today what I'd like to do is just signal high level and general support for the direction of all four of these bills, quite frankly. We believe that they do move the state of Oregon into alignment or toward alignment with the ACA, and that a couple of them actually really suggest some policy direction that we think is thoughtful and probably in the best interest of Oregonians. So just really quickly, we have been, as I said, we've been involved in the reinsurance, the supplemental reinsurance program process. Our actuaries and team have been engaged, and we are definitely supportive of that effort. We think that it's a really important short-term temporary tool to help mitigate and smooth out some of those early impacts. I do just want to make a brief reminder for those of you. In addition to commercial Medicaid and Medicare, we're the CCO in Central Oregon and also the Gorge. And we have also been, since the program's inception, the statewide carrier of the Healthy Kids Connect program, and which is a program that we think has been really important for bringing more children into coverage whose families might not have been able to afford health insurance. So we feel like it's been a win for Oregon. It's been a win for Pacific Source. And while we're not eager at the potential loss of membership, we do support this particular policy proposal. We look forward to looking at the language, but just want to signal support for that. I think in closing, really just again echoing that this has been a lot of work, collective work over the last 18 months. Carriers have been really involved. We have been at the, almost every table, it feels like, and it's been a good partnership. And we appreciate the fact that Oregon is apparently seen as a leader around some of this work, and I think that is terrific. But at the same time, I think leadership is really only as good as there is sort of quality in your execution. So our caution is to, we're not going to get everything right out of the gates, but let's make sure that we're being as thoughtful as we can be so that we can be as close to getting it right as possible, even if it means we might need to take a little more time. And then just my last broken record remark, which I think many of you have heard me make, is please, our request of legislators is to be judicious in terms of other somewhat unrelated legislation that really may not move us directly toward alignment and implementation of the ACA in 2014. So just a caution around introducing additional pressures and changes at a time of really significant change. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien, healthcare advocate with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer group. I'll try to keep this brief. OSPIRG is very enthusiastically in support of the direction that this package of bills is going in and the whole approach to implementing the ACA proposed by Governor Kitzhaber's administration. We're excited to work with the administration and the insurance division toward full implementation of the critical protections that the ACA will bring that will make healthcare work better for all Oregonians, and specifically the direction that the governor's approach is taking that will make those reforms work better for Oregon's own unique health insurance market. And in particular, today I wanted to talk about the state supplemental reinsurance program. I definitely look forward to the opportunity to dig into the details when the bill is available, but I just wanted to have it on the record that we very much support the idea of pursuing a robust state supplemental reinsurance program. A well-designed, well-executed reinsurance program can help contain premium costs for Oregonians over the next few years, which is a sorely needed step in light of the anticipated possibility of significant premium increases in the absence of this step. It's sorely needed in a market that's already seen healthcare costs nearly double in the past 10 years. This whole package of bills, I would say, represents an important step forward for Oregon, but I would urge the committee not to consider these bills in a vacuum. These bills will not work to do everything that we would hope to see in the commercial insurance market without action taken in other areas. In particular, I would say the fact that Oregon has a robust health insurance rate review program is really central to the success of especially the state reinsurance program, because we can't ensure that consumers and small businesses will actually reap the gains of these reforms without reviewing the effect that these risk mitigation programs have on the premium rates that are proposed and reviewed in Oregon's rate review process. And I think Oregon is in a great position to make sure that that succeeds. And I look forward to working with the insurance division to really look closely at this issue when rates are filed in April. Finally, I just want to say that I think the really exciting thing for us about the reinsurance and rate mitigation efforts is that it will help buy our state and our healthcare system some much-needed time to deal with some of the underlying drivers of health inflation and skyrocketing healthcare costs. It will take away some of the sense of immediate crisis that I think some of us have been feeling, especially in the wake of the Wakely report, pun not intended. I think that these efforts will help take away some of that sense of crisis, and it will give us some time to start aligning the different policy levers that we have in the state, including health insurance rate review, the exchange, CCO development, PEB, OEB, other public payers, really the whole spectrum of healthcare in Oregon, to start doing the hard work of bending the cost curve and pursuing the triple aim. I just want to briefly mention that Ausberg is going to be releasing a report with our detailed recommendations on how health insurance rate review in particular could be improved along these lines. Health insurance rate review is only one small part of a bigger puzzle, but I think it is an important one. So in closing, I would say we urge your support for the bills under consideration today. And we would additionally urge your support for efforts to take advantage of the present opportunity and the time that the state supplemental reinsurance program will give us to really further the hard work of bending the cost curve for healthcare in the state. Thank you.
You remind us that it's going to be basically a nightmare for insurance companies to get rates ready for an April submission when they won't have any experience with the members they got as a part of the exchange. It's going to be a very interesting enterprise, I think. Thank you very much.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Thank you. Marion, you had mentioned some of the other legislation around mandates that you're concerned contributing to cost. I'm wondering if you're, which ones you had in mind?
Well, that's a good segue question. I mean, obviously, we are concerned about any bills that are either going to, at this point, increase regulation. Rate review would be a good example right now during a time when we're trying to come into compliance with the ACA and sort of land on what the landscape is going to look like, noting also that we also have a very robust rate review system here in Oregon. But really, we're trying to actually land on our rates, which we need to file April 30th. So quite frankly, any bill that significantly or substantively changes during session, I mean, we're filing our rates midway through, so that's very complicated. We also really are encouraging folks to really measure each bill against affordability right now, because we have some good guesses around certain impacts, and then there are other areas, as you suggest, Chair Greenlick, where we really don't know what it's going to look like. So we're just...
Even April of 14 is going to be a problem.
Correct. Yeah. So really, we are requesting a certain amount of caution. We have done some pretty significant change and transformation. I think it's important to step back and allow some of those changes to actually settle into place a little bit, so that we can evaluate them, find out how they're working and how they might need to be improved.
The answer is anything.
Who knows?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we now have Elise Brown, Lisa Trussell, and Betsy Earls? And when they're done, we'll have our final witness, Reagan Gray. Unless there's anybody else that wants to testify. We might have a few minutes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon, and I am so happy to say I'm here in support of a bill.
Yes.
We're here in support of House Bill 2240, and presuming we'll be in support of the Dash 2 amendments, but haven't gone over them yet. And I wanted to speak directly to one of the amendments that I believe are in the Dash 2, and that deals with the federal taxes and fees that will be implemented upon health insurers January 1st of 2014. So what we've requested as an amendment is the an implementation route very similar to how Oregon addressed the health insurance premium tax a few sessions ago, where we were allowed to implement it in the middle of the policy year rather than waiting until the renewal. So there should be an amendment in the Dash 2s that addresses, as of January 1, a one-time ability for carriers to initiate the federal fees. And the biggest one is the carrier fee, which for our company is about $12 per member per month, 12 and some change, which we will pay at the end of the first quarter in 2014 based on this year's membership. So it's a liability that we carry but we're currently not pricing for. There's a $5.25 piece for the federal reinsurance program. And then the last one, which is not a major piece, is the $1 per member per year, which I don't know why the feds are collecting that one, but that's another fee that's in there. And also, we're here in support of the reinsurance program. We think it'll be critical in order for the individual market to mitigate some of the rate shock that we know that they're going to see come January 1st of 2014. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Elise Brown for LifeWise Health Plan of Oregon this afternoon. And I think, like Lisa says and those before me, it's great to be here in celebration of this legislation. I'm going to speak real specifically to 2240. And there's a reason that you don't have anybody up here hammering in opposition. And I did want to highlight the very reason for that is because this process for us to get here has been an outstanding one. It's been one that working with the insurance division has been inclusive and collaborative, and that's how we've got here. There is one instance or one issue that I wanted to just bring up again that Mr. Holt did before me, and this is an issue that we brought up in our process, was the idea that a gold plan requirement was a condition for licensure, both in and outside the exchange. And we have a problem with that, understanding that the Dash 3s would remove that requirement. I'm asking that we have an opportunity to continue that discussion, and we'd support that. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. I take it you support the Dash 3s, then?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI has about 1,900 members across the state. The majority of those are small businesses, and the majority of those are businesses under 25 employees. So we have a pretty good representation of those employers that are working to purchase health insurance for their companies and working on the small group level. One of the key tenets of the Oregon Business Plan, which is something that we work with the entire business community on every year, is a focus on reducing costs and improving quality in the healthcare system. And as implementation of the ACA has looked like destabilizing the health insurance market and continuing to destabilize the health insurance market going forward, it will be very important for all of us to provide strong economic incentives to support our continued pursuit of those goals. Specifically, I think AOI is looking to encourage our employers to use the exchange, and we would like it to be very attractive to people to purchase insurance in the individual market if they're eligible and don't have access to other insurance, instead of foregoing insurance altogether and paying the what's a frankly much cheaper penalty, and probably extremely attractive if you're between the ages of 19 and 26 or even a little older. Unfortunately, as the ACA moves forward, it requires changes that will provide disincentives for those very things. As Oregon's high-risk pools blend into the overall individual market beginning in 2014, I know that you've heard that it will increase rates dramatically for some purchasers, possibly by as much as 22% being attributable directly to the blending of the high-risk pools alone, and probably more than that for all the changes together. So I think for Oregonians that purchase individual health insurance coverage, and particularly those that are not eligible for subsidies, which means a good number of our employees who might be looking to purchase individual insurance, perhaps moving out of an employer plan and into the exchange, that means they'll bear the full impact of those cost increases. And in a lot of cases, if those increases are too extreme, they will look at foregoing insurance and paying the penalties instead. And I think we all know what happens when people go without insurance and have a major health crisis. They end up in the emergency room. Generally, they're not able to pay the entire cost of their care, and that ends up becoming a cost shift to the employer community, which drives our costs of health care higher even than they are already rising. So as higher costs also destabilize the individual market, we're very concerned that the smaller insurance companies in Oregon that make our market so competitive and vibrant will be looking to withdraw from the state. And we're concerned that fewer insurance companies mean that we will see less competition here in Oregon, and that will cause premiums to rise further. So these are some of the problems that AOI and the business community has been considering as we look at the proposal for a temporary assessment to create a state reinsurance program to help smooth the path in the individual market as we move toward full implementation of the ACA. We don't obviously have the LC draft yet, the legislation, but what our expectation is that legislation to authorize the proposal will set caps on assessments. It will sunset the program after 3 years, and it will require that any funds that are remaining at the end of the 3 years be returned to employers. So it really is a limited program that gives employers some assurances that the money won't go on and on forever or be used to backfill in other programs. And I should say it was very important to our board, and it's very important that you all know that for if the proposal moves forward, our support will be contingent on the current 1% premium tax that's going for healthy kids right now to sunset on schedule. The employer community is just not going to be able to bear the cost of a new reinsurance assessment and healthy kids, the 1% healthy kids premium tax as well. So if we can meet those criteria, we're looking very much forward to working with you on a temporary state reinsurance proposal. And we do hope to support the individual market and smooth our entry into the remaining provisions of the ACA.
Thank you. Any questions, this panel? Thank you very much. Reagan Gray? And anybody else? We have a couple more 5-minute slots.
Last but not least, correct? Yes. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Reagan Gray, and I'm testifying as the co-chair of the Healthy Kids Steering Committee. And the Healthy Kids Steering Committee has been charged with looking at the experience of recipients of Healthy Kids on the program. At our most recent meeting, we discussed and analyzed a disenrollment survey that was sent to families who had left the Healthy Kids program, either the Healthy Kids program or the Healthy Kids Connect program, which is that 200 to 300% category. And so I wanted to highlight a couple of things that we learned from that. Most of the Healthy Kids Connect recipients who left the Healthy Kids program did so because of dissatisfaction with costs and a perception that their the money they were putting in, they weren't getting enough of a benefit out of it in the services that they received. One quarter of those who left the program ended up going without insurance. Some went onto the private market, but 25% went without insurance. So we're extremely pleased to see that OHA wants to address this issue and are very supportive of House Bill 2091. And we at the Healthy Kids Steering Committee will continue to monitor this process as they put it into place, and we'll advise them. Thank you.
That was a pretty low effective premium, wasn't it, in that, you know?
The premium in the Healthy Kids Connect program, yes, but even that burden seemed to be too much. And as you also heard from Dr. Goldberg, that the benefits in the OHP program will be higher.
But the premium on that bill was, on that, for the people who were paying premium, was like $25 a month, is that right?
I believe it was, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I believe it was a percentage of families' income, and so I believe it was less than 10%. But again, I should leave it to the agency to answer that correctly. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I plan, three of these bills have intermediate stops before they get to the town hall, so it would be my intention to move them as fast as we have them to Ways and Means or other places. On Monday, we'll also have, I hope, 2216, is that? 2216, which is the hospital assessment renewal. We'll have some luminaries from the hospital community be here to tell us how much they support that bill. And if all goes well, we'll move that to revenue on Monday if we have all the paperwork and everything looks fine. We have a few other bills, so we're going to be busy. Mr. Administrator, how many bills do we have on our agenda at the moment?
The bills are assigned to the committee.
Yeah.
We have about 130 bills and counting as Senate bills start to come over.
Yeah, so we have well over 100 House bills. We have a lot of work to do, so we'll be trying to move along expeditiously. In the meantime, as of 2:25, we are adjourned. Oh, I need to, wait a minute, unadjourned. Close all those hearings. Now we're adjourned. You can't leave them just hanging there, right?
Valid. Do a Google search.